Habakkuk, Part 2. The second talk on the book of Habakkuk was presented by Peter Wieringa on July 2, 2006 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Whose recordings, whose writings are contained at the very end of the Old Testament. And let me just recap a couple of things from our study this last week, address a couple of issues that were raised this last week, and then we're going to finish up the book. We got through the first part of chapter 2 last week, and this week we're going to finish up the end of the book. But let me just give you a real quick historical recap. Habakkuk, again, one of the minor prophets, he wrote, this was recorded and was written about somewhere around 300, a little bit over 300 years after Solomon's time. So if you're trying to find a historical time frame there, it's after Solomon's time by about 300 years. It's about 100 years after the 10 northern tribes, Israel, the nation of Israel, about 100 years, a little bit over 100 years, after they were dispersed. It is about just a few years after Josiah, king of Judah, after Josiah had been killed in battle. Josiah, if you remember from reading your Old Testament, Josiah was the king who brought about all sorts of reforms in the nation of Judah. He found the law, or some of his people rediscovered the law in the temple, and they began to reform much of the worship. They began to get rid of a lot of the high places, the idols, that sort of thing. Those were the reforms of Josiah. Then Josiah was killed, and this book was written just a few years, most likely. We don't know for sure, but I think it's most likely it was written just a few years after Josiah died. And it was written just 10, 20 years before the children, before the Jews in Judah were carried off into captivity in Babylon. So that just gives you some historical context there. Right around 600 BC, sometime in there was the time that I think that this book was written. And let me just go over a couple of questions that came up this last week in the study that we had. There was some question about exactly to whom this book was addressed, or to whom this oracle, this revelation was addressed. I think some very, very good questions came up in that regard. One of the questions was stimulated by comparing a verse out of the passage that we looked at last week with a New Testament quotation of the same verse. In Habakkuk 2, verse 4, it says, "Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith." We're real familiar with that phrase, the righteous will live by his faith. We see that phrase in Romans, in Galatians, in Hebrews. And what raises the question is in Hebrews 10, that verse is rendered very differently. The righteous shall live by his faith, that's familiar to us. But the verses around it in Hebrews 10 are rendered differently. And so there's a question that needs to be asked with regard to how we interpret the scriptures. The question that needs to be asked is, when the New Testament uses an Old Testament quote, do they use it in a cavalier manner, or do they render the Old Testament quote faithfully and the idea faithfully? I remember over the years, hearing folks discuss New Testament references to the Old Testament, when the Old Testament would be quoted in the New Testament. And there are times, there are places like this one in Hebrews 10, there are places where the rendering, the quotation, is very different from the translation that we have in our English Bibles in our Old Testament. the quotation is so different that you begin to wonder if it's even the same quote. And I have had folks over the years suggest that New Testament writers, because they are inspired by God, are at liberty to use the Old Testament any darn way they want to. Well, I don't think that's the case, and I don't think that Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews, is using the quotation from Habakkuk in a way that Habakkuk hadn't intended. I think that they're using it in a very similar way. So then the question goes to just exactly to whom is this book, or are these ideas, to whom are they addressed in this account? Because if, in fact, the New Testament quotations of the Old Testament are going to be consistent with the Old Testament intention, with the intention of the writers of the Old Testament, well, then we need to wrestle with and grapple a little bit with, to whom was Habakkuk written in the first place? Well, and what I was suggesting to you last week is that at least to some degree, and this question was raised last week also, that at least to some degree, the oracle was addressed to the Chaldeans. Now, I'm not going to suggest that it was addressed exclusively to the Chaldeans. And going back to Hebrews, in Hebrews 10, it seems to me as though the intention of I think Paul wrote Hebrews, the intention of the author of Hebrews is basically to frame, to put that quotation from Habakkuk in the context of understanding what it means for one to persevere when they have heard the truth and have embraced the truth, understanding what it means for them to persevere, and that's fundamentally what the writer of Hebrews, and I would suggest Habakkuk, is talking about when he talks about the righteous will live by faith. It has to do with hearing something and persevering in pursuing and following what is true. And in Hebrews, obviously, we go from Hebrews chapter 10 to Hebrews chapter 11, which is this tremendous account of men and women of faith of the Old Testament. Well, I think it's all part of the same theme, all part of the same idea that the writer of Hebrews is drawing on from Habakkuk. So then the question is Habakkuk addressing this just to the Jews, or is he addressing it to the Jews and the Chaldeans, or is he addressing it just to the Chaldeans? And what I would suggest is that there's a real sense in which the intention is for this to be addressed to both the Jews and the Chaldeans. One of the questions that was asked last week had to do with the question of whether or not the Jews were as bad as the Chaldeans. Well, yeah, I think that the message in this book fits just as well for the Jews who were living in Judah at the time, the nation of Judah, fits just as well for them as it does for the Chaldeans. And I'm going to even take it a step further and suggest to you that the Chaldeans, in a sense, have the opportunity here to respond again to what God is saying and doing. What I'm going to suggest to you is that this book is not the first time that the Chaldeans have come in contact with or have had to wrestle with who God is. That then leads me to the bigger picture, the bigger idea that I want you to think through and I want you to consider as you do your own study, and that is, I believe that throughout the Old Testament, even though the Old Testament account zeroes in like a laser on God's relationship with the Jews, that is not the sum total of what God has done throughout history. And if you read the Old Testament accounts, you'll see again and again and again that God deals with the Jews, but he deals with those who are outside the nation of Israel, or in this case, Judah. He deals with those who are outside of Judaism as well. The book of Job was written about a man who, as far as we can tell, was not a Jew. There are characters in the Old Testament who come along, Rahab the harlot, for example. There are characters who come along who are not Jews and who figure prominently in what God is doing, in his activity. And so what I'm suggesting is that throughout the Old Testament, God has consistently communicated with, dealt with, had concern with those who are outside of the children of Israel, outside of the Jewish race as well. And I think this is a case where that's going on. Let me just give you some examples with regard to this whole idea of God dealing with people outside of the Jews. I believe it goes all the way back to the garden. And I have this picture in my mind. Years ago, I wanted to write some kind of a novel. I'm not a novelist, so I could never quite get around to it. But I had this picture in my mind of a novel based on the fact that all of humanity has the same history in Adam and Eve, where God, in talking with Adam and Eve in the garden, when he pronounced the curse on Adam, Eve, and the serpent, Adam and Eve were there listening in, and in that account, God, in pronouncing the curse on the serpent, says to them, with regard to Eve, he says that one of Eve's descendants will crush the serpent's head, even though the serpent will bruise the heel of one of her descendants. And I've had in my mind this novel about the fact that the gospel, I would suggest, the gospel was preached in the garden by God himself to Adam and Eve, and would then be a part of the traditional history, the word-of-mouth history, that every nation on earth would share. Now, obviously, that would be corrupted as the years go by, the story would get lost, the story wouldn't always be retold faithfully or anything like that. But the reality is that from the very beginning, God was dealing with had an interest in dealing with the entire world. And we see that then in the account of Abram. With Abram, we see God speaking to him and communicating to him that his seed, one of his descendants, will be a blessing to all the nations, it says. And that's what I would suggest this morning, is that God has always been interested in all the nations. It isn't simply the Jews that he's interested in. It isn't simply this one ethnic group that he is pursuing and has a relationship with. I would suggest he has been interested in the entire world. What we have in the Old Testament is a focused account of God dealing with his chosen people in a way that was intended to teach the other nations. But God has always, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't want us to think in terms of God was interested in the Jews and the Jews alone and didn't have anything to do with anybody else. And we know that that's true also by the account. I, in my mind and in my study, I link together God's observations to Moses in Exodus 19, when he talks about the Jews being a holy nation, a royal priesthood, a people for God's own connection, or for God's own people for God's own possession. When God talks to Moses about that, and when Peter in 1 Peter 2 uses those same verses in the context of talking about God's interaction with the entire world, what I would suggest is that God's intention all along was that the Jews be a light and a testimony and a witness to other people. What the Jews did was they just sort of circled the wagons. They just sort of pulled in, and rather than allowing themselves to be that testimony and that witness, they tended to try to separate themselves and divorce themselves from any other people. But I would suggest that God's intention from the very beginning was that the Jews themselves, as a people for his own possession, God's intention was that they would be a witness and a testimony to other people. Well, then there's even more plainly, even more boldly, there's the account that we have in Jonah, which was written about 100 years before Habakkuk was written, probably a little bit more than 100 years before Habakkuk was written. And we all remember the story. We all remember it from Sunday school. Jonah was sent to preach to the Ninevites. And if you were to look at your map in the back of your Bible and look for Nineveh, you would find that Nineveh is in the exact place that the Chaldeans come from. The Ninevites came to be identified with the Assyrians, and it was the Assyrians that were replaced by the Chaldeans that are being addressed here in the book of Habakkuk. And that account, the account of Jonah, when you stop and think about it, is a remarkable account because God tells Jonah to go and preach to the city of Nineveh. Jonah has no interest in doing that. God forces his hand, sends him. The Ninevites repent. The Ninevites turn from their idolatry, turn from their sin. They repent, and God extends grace to them. Now, there's another whole part of that story with Jonah getting ticked off at God then for doing that. But the point is that it was God's intention that Jonah go to the Ninevites. The Ninevites weren't Jews. The Ninevites were in a different part of the world altogether and were the predecessors, if you will, the ancestors of the Chaldeans that we're talking about here in Habakkuk. And then there are a couple of contemporary accounts. One thing I forgot to mention this last week is that the books of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel are roughly contemporary with Habakkuk. They include the time just before or just after Habakkuk did his writing here, had his vision. And if you read those accounts, you will likewise see God dealing very specifically with the Chaldeans. In Jeremiah 50 and 51, God is very specific, in some cases virtually by name, dealing with the Chaldeans and with the things that they're doing and pronouncing woes upon them and condemning them. And I don't think that when God did that in Jeremiah 50 and 51, for example, I don't think that that was simply for the Jews' benefit. I think that when God, in those chapters, in prior chapters, God addressed other nations, when God addressed himself to the sins and the wickedness of other nations, I believe it was at least in part for their benefit as well. So that if perchance they should hear what God had to say, God's observations about them, they would have the opportunity to repent, to turn and repent. And then very explicitly in Daniel, obviously you just can't avoid in Daniel the fact that Daniel, when he is carried off into captivity, so that's a little while after Habakkuk was written, when Daniel is carried off to captivity, he addresses Nebuchadnezzar, who is at the point, I think, that when Habakkuk was written, I think Nebuchadnezzar was probably the head of the army. He was the son of the Chaldean ruler at the time. I think that Nebuchadnezzar was the head of the army who was soon to be the leader of the Chaldeans. So Nebuchadnezzar is addressed very specifically by name in Daniel. And then after Nebuchadnezzar, his son Belshazzar, and then Darius, and then Cyrus, they're all addressed specifically in Daniel, with Daniel interacting with them, calling them to repentance. You see, that's the account in the book of Daniel, the account of what goes on with Nebuchadnezzar, where Daniel very carefully, specifically, in clear ways, communicates to Nebuchadnezzar who God is, how Nebuchadnezzar's pride and arrogance are an affront to God, calls him to repentance. Nebuchadnezzar ends up, as God had prophesied, as God had planned, Nebuchadnezzar ends up in sort of self-exile for a little while. And then he does, in fact, in some sense, in some way, repent. If you read through Daniel, there are a couple of cases or a couple of indications that Nebuchadnezzar had some sort of submissive response to who God is. Now, it doesn't necessarily seem to have lasted, but my point is that in the book of Daniel, God is speaking very directly to the leaders of the Chaldeans. So, my point is simply that given all that background, given all that historical understanding, the information that we have from the other books, I think that what we're going to see here in this passage in the book of Habakkuk is that God's intention is that those who have heard from him and have been called to a response of faith to him, that they persevere in that response of faith. That's clearly true with Habakkuk himself, and that's what we're going to look at today, especially as we get into chapter 3. But I would suggest that it's true of the Chaldeans as well, that the Chaldeans, having heard in some sense, in some way over the years from God, that it was God's intention that the Chaldeans, likewise, in hearing this oracle that he has given to Habakkuk, that the Chaldeans likewise respond in faith and in submission to who God is. And the context itself suggests to me that that much of this is addressed to the Chaldeans. It seems to me as though when in chapter 2, in the first few verses here, especially in verses 4 and 5, it seems to me as though the Chaldeans are being described here perhaps more than the Jews are. When Habakkuk refers to the proud one, his soul is not right within him, certainly that would apply to the Jews, because we saw from chapter 1 that things were in disarray amongst the Jews right then. There was all sorts of idolatry, all sorts of terrible things going on under the reign of Jehoiakim at that time. So, yes, it applies to the Jews, but then when he goes on in verse 5 and he talks about wine betrays the haughty man so that he does not stay at home. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, and he is like death, never satisfied. He also gathers to himself all nations and collects to himself all peoples. It seems to me as though that reference is probably more to the Jews, more to the Chaldeans rather, than it is to the Jews, because that seems to reflect what observations were made in chapter 1 about the Chaldeans and about the way they swept through the nations and overran the nations and were never satisfied with their conquest. They always wanted to conquer more. My point is, it isn't the focus of the book. The focus of the book has to do with what a faithful response to God is all about. But I think it's worth noting that God, I believe, speaks not just to the Jews, but speaks to other peoples as well. And I believe that that we would find that message consistent throughout the Old Testament. We would consistently find times that God is addressing a people who are outside the Jewish nation. That's part of his plan. Well, then let's go on and go through the rest of the book here. And it actually won't take us terribly long to go through the last couple of chapters. In chapter 2, from about verse 6, or actually the middle of verse 6 through the end of chapter 2, what we see is God pronouncing a series of woes upon the Chaldeans. And in doing that, what he's doing is making observations about who the Chaldeans are, about how they behave, about their attitudes, about how they approach things. And there is something for us to learn from those accounts as well. I'm not going to go through all of them in great detail, but there are many places throughout the Old Testament with regard to the Chaldeans. I've already mentioned Jeremiah 50 and 51. There are many places where God points out in some detail the sins, the shortcomings, the errors of people. In some cases, the Jews. In this case, it happens to be the Chaldeans, I believe, that he's pointing that out about. But he does that with a series of five woes. In chapter 2, verses 6 through 8, he pronounces a woe upon the one who steals, the one who takes things that are not their own. He uses phrases like the one who increases what is not his, the one who borrows and seems to do that in a promiscuous manner without perhaps even an intention to repay, the one who has looted many nations. He's pronouncing a woe upon the one who basically appropriates things that are not his. In chapter 2, verses 9 through 11, there's a woe upon him who, it seems to me that the focus here is the one who takes things in order to provide for his own security, and I would suggest his own security without regard to trusting God. In this passage, he talks about, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house to put his nest on high to be delivered from the hand of calamity in verse 9. Well, that's, I think, that gets back to the heart of what this book is talking about, and that is the individual, the Chaldeans, who consider themselves to be completely self-sufficient, who consider themselves to be their own God or their own source of authority. There are those passages that we talked about last week. I think that's what God is addressing here in this second woe to the Chaldeans. In the third woe, in verses 12 through 14, he's talking about those who are bloodthirsty and violent, who build a city with bloodshed, found towns with violence. In chapter 2, verses 15 through 17, he talks about the Chaldeans oppressing their neighbors, about the ones who take advantage of and abuse their neighbors. And what he does, and this is going to be, this is part of the bigger theme of Habakkuk, what he does is he tells the Chaldeans, those who do that will have the cup come around and will themselves be oppressed. And that gets back to what I think are a couple of the major themes of this book. We talked a little bit about this last week, but a couple of the major themes have to do with, first of all, the fact that God is at liberty to do what he wants to do, the way he wants to do it, when he wants to do it. When Habakkuk looks around and says, "How long, O Lord?" and he's concerned, he's fearful, frightened about what's going on in the world around him. And what God says to Habakkuk in chapter 1 is, what I'm doing is going to be a surprise to you because I'm bringing the Chaldeans. What that indicates to us is that God, being the sovereign, transcendent God that he is at liberty to do things the way he wants to, when he wants to, without regard, quite honestly, to the way we think things should be done. It's easy for us to think in terms of a reasonable God would do things a certain way, would do things in a way that seem reasonable to us. But this book points out to us that that's just not the case. But then the second part of that, we saw that in chapter 1, and we're also seeing it in the verses that we're talking about right now. The second part of that is God communicates to Habakkuk that God will do justice. You see, it's not as though when God does things the way he wants to, in his own time, in his own way, it's not as though God is careless about what is right. It's not as though he is careless about what is just or what is good. Those things are at the very core of who God is. His righteousness, his goodness, his fairness, those things are at the very core of who he is. And so when he does something that seems to us to be unfair, unjust, unkind, when we see circumstances, I would suggest, in our own lives, where things seem to be completely unfair and completely unjust, when we see things, there's a reality to what we're seeing. I don't want to deny that. I don't want to suggest that it is just in our perception, because from our perspective, injustice is done from times. We are victims of injustice. We are victims of unkind people, of unloving things being done to us. There's a reality to that. But what God tells Habakkuk here, and what he tells the Chaldeans in this woe that he pronounces on them in chapter 2, verses 15 to 17, what God communicates is that he will make things right. Let there be no mistake about that. Let there not be any concern that somehow or other God has become unjust or God is not powerful enough to rectify things. That is part of the faith that we have in God, is understanding that he is just and good and righteous, and that in his way, in his time, he will bring about justice, righteousness, goodness. And that's part of the message of Habakkuk. Part of what we're called to respond to in submission is, even when the Chaldeans are at the doorstep, and even when all hell is broken loose, and even when things are chaotic, and even when things are seem to be going terribly, horribly wrong, still, in the midst of that, God knows what he's doing, and he will make things right. Not necessarily in a way or at a time that we will see it. That's part of the message of Hebrews 11 that we've looked at in the past. Part of that message is that there's something that believers are looking forward to. We don't always have our hopes and our expectations realized in this life even. But part of the big picture is that God will in fact make things right. Well, then he also, in verses chapter 2, verses 18 through 20, he pronounces a woe upon the Chaldeans for their idolatry. And I love it when there are Old Testament passages like this, because it just points out how ludicrous idolatry is, how ludicrous it is, as it talks about here in these three verses, for someone to take a block of wood or a stone or something like that and to fashion an idol and to worship it. How silly that is. They take something that can't speak, it can't act, it doesn't have appendages that move, it doesn't have a brain, and yet people take something like that, form an idol, and worship it. And that's what Habakkuk is pointing out here in these verses. What profit is the idol? Verse 18. What profit is the idol when its maker has carved it, or an image, a teacher of falsehood? For its maker trusts in his own handiwork when he fashions speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a piece of wood, awake, to a dumb stone, arise. And that is your teacher? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all inside it. But the Lord, and here's the contrast that God makes very clear to Habakkuk, but the Lord, as opposed to these idols, these speechless, mindless idols, but the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth be silent before him. Well, that's how this section of Habakkuk is concluded, where God has, in the first chapter, he has talked about what is going to happen in actual events as the Chaldeans come in and sweep through the nation of Judah, as Judean society is completely disrupted, thrown into chaos. It already is in chaos under the corruption of Jehoiakim, but it's going to become even worse when the Chaldeans come. He gives us that historical context. At the start of chapter 2, Habakkuk's response to that is that he'll be like a watchman on the rampart, watching and waiting to see what God's going to do. Then God indicates what he's going to do with the Chaldeans. He indicates, he speaks of his judgment against the Chaldeans. Woe to the Chaldeans who do these different things. And then in chapter 3, we have a prayer. We're told here in verse 1, we have a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet. So what we have in the rest of the book is Habakkuk's response to all that God has revealed to him, to all that God has done, and to all that God is about to do with the nation of Judah. And this response is a beautiful account of Habakkuk's faithful submission to God. I say faithful because Habakkuk is looking to God, turning to God, relying upon God, rather than upon his own handiwork, his own strength, his own tools, rather than in any way his own idols, relying upon himself. Habakkuk is turning in reliance to God. And I say submission because, as we'll see in chapter 3 here in a little bit, what he is submitting to is horrible. What God is calling Habakkuk to submit to, and what Habakkuk and the rest of the Jews in Judah do in fact experience, is a horrible existence at this time. And yet that's what Habakkuk faithfully and submissively responds to. And we can see that just as we read through chapter 2 here, chapter 3 rather. Chapter 3, verse 2, Habakkuk's prayer, he says, Lord, I have heard the report about thee, and I fear, with good reason. He's heard what God is going to do in bringing in the Chaldeans. The Chaldeans are that fierce and impetuous people, that cruel and ruthless and horrible people. Habakkuk has good reason to fear what is going to happen. And that is sometimes true in our lives as well. When we look at our circumstances and look at what's coming down the pike, and we have good reason to fear and good reason to be concerned about what's going to happen. I've heard the reports about you, and I fear, O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. And that's Habakkuk's plea from the bottom of his heart, his helpless but hopeful plea to God to, in the midst of his wrath toward Judah to remember his mercy toward his people. And then he, in the next few verses, he gives an account of who God is. He talks a little bit about a historical context, about God's activity in dealing with the Jews over the many, many years from the time that they were in Egypt to their coming into the Promised Land. And these references, these place references, seem to be references to those times and to God's activity in the life of the Jews. God comes from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covers the heavens, and the earth is full of his praise. His radiance is like the sunlight. He has rays flashing from his hand, and there is the hiding of his power. Before him goes pestilence, and plague comes after him. He stood and surveyed the earth. He looked and startled the nations. Yes, the perpetual mountains were shattered. The ancient hills collapsed. His ways are everlasting. I saw the tents of Cushan under distress. The tent curtains of the land of Midian were trembling. Then he goes on and pronounces something of God's judgment against sin and unrighteousness. And in this context, the Jews need to pay attention to that, and the Chaldeans need to pay attention to that. God will rightly, justly judge any and all who oppose him. Did the Lord rage against the rivers, or was thine anger against the rivers, or was thy wrath against the sea, that thou didst ride on thy horses, on thy chariots of salvation? Thy bow was made bare, the rods of chastisement were sworn. Thou didst cleave the earth with rivers, the mountains saw thee and quaked, the downpour of waters swept by, the deep uttered forth its voice, it lifted high its hands, sun and moon stood in their places. They went away at the light of thine arrows, at the radiance of thy gleaming spear. In indignation thou didst march through the earth. In anger thou didst trample the nations. Thou didst go forth for the salvation of thy people, for the salvation of thine anointed. Thou didst strike the head of the house of the evil, to lay him open from thigh to neck. Thou didst pierce with his own spears the head of the throngs. They stormed in to scatter us. Their exultation was like those who devour the oppressed in secret. Thou didst tread on the sea with thy horses and on the surge of many waters. That's just a picture of God's judgment against the Chaldeans. And if you want to see that pictured more fully, again, look at Jeremiah 50 and 51. It's a picture of God's judgment against the Chaldeans, against any people, whether the Chaldeans, the Jews, or anyone else, against any people who oppose God and who refuse to submit to God. Well, then the last four verses here, for me, are some of the most poignant, some of the most beautiful verses in all of the scriptures, as they express Habakkuk's faithful submission to who God is in spite of what's going on around him. And the words speak for themselves. In verse 18, Habakkuk says, I heard, and my inward parts trembled. At the sound, my lips quivered. Decay enters my bones, and in my place I tremble, because I must wait quietly for the day of distress, for the people to arise who will invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail, and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold, and there be no cattle in the stalls, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. The Lord is my strength. He has made my feet like hinds' feet, and makes me walk on my high places. That, to me, is the most extraordinary expression of what all of the scriptures talk about. And that is what it means to submit faithfully to who God is. Not because and not at the times that life is good, but to submit to God and to turn to him in faith and in submission at those very times when it seems as though he is least in control, when it seems as though he is least loving, least just. Those are the very times that we can most clearly, faithfully, submissively turn to him. And that's what Habakkuk is saying here. I would suggest that's the message of all of the Old Testament. That's the message of all of the New Testament. And that is to respond to God, persevere in that faith and in that submission to Him in spite of the circumstances that we find ourselves in. Well, with that, I'm finished with Habakkuk. Does anybody have any questions, any comments, observations about the passage that we've looked at? Anybody?
So in the second chapter, where it makes that reference to the righteous shall live by faith, like you're saying, the context around it seems to be talking a lot about Chaldeans. So in your opinion, is the book in that section addressed to both Israel and to the Chaldeans? Or do you favor one or the other? Do you think it's just hard to tell?
I guess the conclusion that I have come to is that it is addressed to those who have heard from God and are being asked to respond again faithfully and in submission to God. The reason I think that is because, and Ron pointed this out, I'm certainly not doing justice to Ron's observations, but this last week he pointed out in discussions afterwards that if you look at the context of the way that verse is used, the just shall live by faith, if you look at the context of the way it's used in Hebrews 10 and the way the verses around it are rendering, I suggested last week in the teaching that the verses suggested it was addressed most specifically to the Chaldeans. Well, I'm modifying that because, again, as you look at Hebrews 10, it seems to be that idea is adjusted to those who have once responded in faith to God and are called still and again to respond in faith to God, to not shrink back. And so specifically the Jews are addressed here. They have got to be clearly addressed here. But I would suggest that, because of other things in the context, I would suggest that the Chaldeans are at least in some sense being addressed here also, perhaps not as specifically, but that the Chaldeans have likewise had the opportunity, not as clear as the Jews have, but have had the opportunity to respond to God in faith, and God's pointing out to them again that the righteous lives by faith, not by the strength of your own arm, not by your armies or your horses or anything like that. That's not where your strength comes from, but it comes from submission to God.
And just a history question. Cyrus is referred to many times in Isaiah. Mm-hmm. Was he a king of the Chaldeans, or was it, which nation was?
Well, if you look at Daniel, you have Nebuchadnezzar and then his son Belshazzar, and then it refers to Darius the Mede and Cyrus, who followed Darius, and they seem to be the leaders, the rulers of what was the Assyrian Empire, became the Chaldeans, the Babylonians. They were all sort of part and parcel of the empire that was over in that part of the world.
Okay,
but that was after this account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's I mean Cyrus or just other places. What you were referring to earlier, that God takes an interest in the Gentile nations around Israel, is kind of very obvious to me from the prophets.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
mm-hmm.
It's even in Isaiah, I think it's chapter 19, where he says that, you know, in that day, you know, Egypt will become my people. You know, and it's an amazing passage. You read through it, mm-hmm. It's like how basically Israel has had an effect on the people around them, mm-hmm. and there's a great following in those nations towards God. So.
Yeah. Isaiah wrote before this account, Cyrus lived after this account.
Right, because it was a prophecy concerning him.
Yeah, just to clarify that. Okay? Anybody else? Any other?
What is that? What is he saying there?
You talk about in chapter 2, verse 19?
Chapter 3, verse 19. It's the last verse.
Tell me more about what you're asking.
Well, I'm just wondering what the image is, because he has made my feet like hinds' feet, and that conjures up an image of, you know, you've got a deer.
Sure.
That has little tiny feet. And then it says, and makes me walk on my high places. So what is the image that he's, what does he mean by my high places?
The image that I have was probably shaped by Hannah Herner's book years ago. And I haven't looked into that in great detail. If you've got any thoughts about that, I'd love to hear from you. But the image that I have is more of a almost an emotional, if you will, visceral response to what it means, the freedom, if you will, that comes from trusting God in spite of all that is going on around us, in spite of, and the picture there of the hinds feet on, I'm not sure specifically why my high places, I'd be interested in your observations there, but the picture that I have is one who, yes, is in somewhat precarious circumstances still, and yet is able to walk nimbly above that, I guess is kind of the picture that I have. But I'd be interested in thoughts that you have.
Well, the reason that I was puzzling here is because in the cross-references in my particular Bible, it sends me to a place in Deuteronomy where it talks about their high places, and it's talking about religious sites of the Canaanites.
Hmm.
But that makes no sense here.
Yeah.
To me whatsoever.
Yeah. Yeah, that wouldn't make sense to me as to why a deer would care about places of worship that are referred to as high places, as opposed to
right.
a deer that would be
just up on the cliffs.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that doesn't make sense to me that would refer to places of worship. Okay? I'm only sweating a little bit here. Now comes Kay's question.
I have a question about the verse right before that.
Okay.
I
don't know anything about that one either, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, I mean, these are verses, you know, I've memorized and I really like, but, you know, when you start to think about it, okay, God's going to womp on us. There's going to be no food. We're all going to die. but I'm going to exalt in God and rejoice in God. And so then I start to think, so what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean, I am starving, you know, I'm so happy? So what does it look like to exalt in God and rejoice in God when he's womping on you?
I was, last week, Stan was asking something similar afterwards, and I struggle to figure out how to put it into words. And all I can really speak to in this case is my own personal response to these things, or to this idea, and that is, I will give you a very specific example that I have used before when I've taught this passage, and that is, back in 1982, 34 years ago now, my older brother, who was my best friend when I was growing up, my older brother, we had gone through a horrible financial and economic time living in Southern California in the real estate development business, when construction loans were running 21-22%. I mean, we had gone through a horrible financial time where we moved out of our house, moved in with them, working two or three jobs, blah, blah, blah. I mean, a horrendous time. That fall, Case and I moved up to Boise for me to be on the pastoral staff of the church up in Boise. And my older brother, as he was traveling from Southern California back to Northern California on business, my brother was, he and in the car with him were his wife and his son. They were struck head on by another car. My brother died. My sister-in-law had some glass in her foot because she got out of the car in shock, walking around. My nephew had his leg broken. That was it. My brother died. And he was my best friend, my mentor, he was the guy who taught me by his example when I was a junior in high school that it was okay to refer to God by his first name, Jesus. Prior to that, I'd grown up in a Christian household, but I didn't really have a real sense of what that was about. So he had been just unbelievably important to me and my entire family. And at 30 years of age, he dies in a senseless car accident when a guy who is on medication and shouldn't have been driving crosses the middle divider of the interstate, mind you, and hits him head on. So in the midst of that, there are, in our family, there are two responses. There is one response of, this is a horrendous thing. This makes no sense. I mean, I was on the phone to him literally seconds before he got in the car. If I had talked with him on the phone a minute or two longer or a minute or two less, I mean, there are all sorts of questions. There are all sorts of what ifs and all sorts of how do you deal with this? How do you handle this? But for me and for most of my family in the midst of that, there was a, when you talk about rejoicing, exalting the Lord, rejoicing the God of my salvation, for me, it wasn't a fun time, but there's a just a profound sense of relief in the fact that God is God, and there is still a purpose for all this, there's still meaning to all this, in spite of how horrible the circumstances are, in spite of how terrible life is. And that's, I guess, what I think that Habakkuk is talking about here when he goes through this litany of things in verse 17. He lists all that is going wrong, and you can't get much worse than the thing that he lists there. I think when he talks about exalting in God and about rejoicing in God, it isn't, well, I was going to say it isn't an emotional happiness, but I would have to say for myself that at the point at which I step back and allow God to be who he is and do what he wants to do without regard to my trying to dictate what's right and fair, for me, that is a tremendously joyful place to be. That is something that I can exalt in, because then it isn't up to me. It isn't up it isn't a matter of, I could have done something more, I should have done something differently. I mean, that isn't what comes into play at all. It's a matter of recognizing who God is and believing that we can trust him for the bigger picture and for keeping everything under control. So I don't know if that, well, the other response within our family was another family member who was a believer, had been a believer for many, many years, who looked at the same situation. I mean, he was with us in the hospital with my nephew and for the funeral and all that sort of thing, and he looked at the same response, and his response is either God is not good or God is not powerful, because Rob wouldn't have died and left a 4-year-old son and a widow, a guy who is that great a guy. He was a great guy. A great guy like that would not have died if God was just powerful, loving. And so for the last 34 years, he has ceased to believe, seemingly. He has no interest at all, because for him, he could not accept, could not see that God would allow that sort of thing to happen. And I think that's the message of the book of Habakkuk, is God does what he wants, and we don't always like it. We often don't like it. Doesn't look very good to us, doesn't look very loving or fair to us or good, but he does what he wants, and yet he is still in control, and yet he will still bring about what is good, what is right, what is just. Does that answer your question at all?
Very nicely.
Okay. Anybody else before we wrap up? Logan, way back in the back there, and then we'll wrap up with that one.
Weren't the Magi that visited Jesus and brought him gifts from these people?
Chaldean. Yeah.
So the Israelites who were carried off into slavery took the scrolls and their stories and their history and their tradition with them, yep, and were studied under the eye of these.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's, that's a good point. That's a big part of the account of Daniel, is in dealing with the Magi, dealing with the wise men of the time, and the Chaldeans supposedly were known in history for their wisdom and for their perception and their awareness of what was going on. So,
and even though the nation as a whole was responsible for keeping and had broken the covenant, some of them lived, and they were all sent back.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So in his wrath, he remembered mercy.
Absolutely. Yep, good point. And that's one of the, one of the interesting, odd things about the way God does things is there are times in our lives where we see things made right. And it's really cool when that happens. But there are times in our lives when we don't see things made right, when things don't work out the way we hope that they will, and things don't seem to be in order, and God is still God. God is still loving, is still just, is still powerful, even when that's our experience, that things aren't quite right. And with that, we're done for the morning.